Hey, what's up? It's Mr. Bill. The track you're listening to right now is the result of a 35-hour tutorial series where I recorded the process of making this song from start to finish and explained myself along the way. If you're interested in learning how to make music or sharpening your craft, go to MrBillsTunes.com and check it out. Enjoy the tune.
Hey, you're listening to the Mr. Bill Podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Mr. Bill Podcast.
Hey, you are listening to the Mr. Bill Podcast.
Hey, you're 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 listening to the Mr. Bill Podcast.
Sick. All right, we're recording. Cool. Well, yeah, I know we chatted about doing this podcast for like 2 years now, so it's good to finally do it. Maybe a good place to start is like you could introduce yourself and tell people who you are, what you do, stuff like that.
Sure. So my name's Andrew, or I use the name NF online. And mostly I'm a programmer, and for the last 14 years I've worked for Google, and for the first like 6 or 7 years of that, I worked on a programming language called Go, which is now a fairly widely used programming language for building all kinds of stuff, but mostly internet server stuff. Since then I've been working on various like developer tooling things, mostly in open source. I've been lucky enough to work on all open source software at Google, which is really cool. So a lot of the stuff that I'm doing now is to do with securing supply chain issues. So, you know, people trying to understand what goes into the software they're building and if there are issues with that. So there's a site called deps.dev, which has an API that my team has built. And I'm also, you know, musician as like a just something I do in my spare time, which is how I got to know you through production stuff. And I'm also on the board of a wildlife hospital, which we're building.
Oh, true.
Where I live.
Okay, and are you still around Byron Bay?
Yeah, it's sort of northern New South Wales area, yeah.
Cool, how'd you get into that?
A friend of mine was donating some money, looking for charities for he's got like a wildlife fund, and then through contacts of his, he found out about this project where they're building a hospital just sort of near where I live. And he said, oh, well, you live around there. You want to go and check it out? And so I went and like met with the people who were behind that project. And I was like so impressed by like the people and the mission and like what they're doing that I was like, how can I help? Like, I've got skills. I don't know how they translate to running a wildlife hospital. Like I'm not a vet or an ecologist or anything. But they said, look, we do need more board members. And so, cause it's a nonprofit, it's like nonprofit board positions, and like what the board is responsible for is ultimately the entire thing happening. And so there's a lot of like stuff that my experience in like technology can really help with. Cause obviously there's a lot of like logistics and stuff. So, I got involved about 8 months ago, maybe, and we're due to open it in July, which is exciting.
And the main goal, you said, is wildlife preservation. So kind of like making sure that native plants, native animals, all that kind of stuff don't get fucked with by the government.
Well, it's a wildlife hospital. So it's people, like people from the community or volunteers bring like injured animals that they found to the hospital, and then they get treated there. And there's the closest similar facility to what we're building is a bit over an hour like north in Queensland. So it's really a place to serve the entire region around here. Like a lot of those, like usually if someone finds like, I don't know, like a koala or, you know, anything, a kookaburra or something that's injured, they'll take it to their vet or something. And like vets in, particularly in the country, they do tons of like unpaid work to treat wildlife, but it's, you know, it's a real, they just do it out of the kindness of their own hearts. They don't, you know, and they don't necessarily have the time or the energy for it. It's very like draining for them. So our project, we've sourced a lot of like funding from the government, from organizations like the World Wildlife Fund, and then using that to build this facility and to pay the staff to run it, and including like vets and vet nurses. And then, yeah, there's tons going on.
Nice. Yeah. I guess one thing I want to ask and talk about is like what goes into developing a programming language. Like I've used programming languages a tiny bit, not very much, and I find them complicated enough just to do anything with like something like Python or JavaScript or something. Like, but there's a step before that, which is somebody has to create the programming language, which to me is like insane. It's like programming is hard enough, let alone like building the thing that you program with. Like, how does that even work?
Yeah. Well, you know, when they first, you know, created computers, you know, the way you interacted with them was like super primitive, and there were no programming languages. You would just like the way computers work at a very, in a very simplified way is that, there's like a CPU inside and there's memory, and the CPU reads like instructions from memory. So instructions like the instruction would be like, read this bit of memory and then read that bit of memory and then add those two numbers together and then store the results somewhere else. And like all those instructions are just like bytes in memory. Initially, like when computers were first, you know, a new thing, like all of those programs would be written by hand. Like you would write, they call it machine code. Like you would write down all the instructions, and then like some of the earliest computers, you would actually use switches on like a panel to like set bit zero to this, bit one to this, bit two to this, and like put like all their bits in and then press a button, say that's the first instruction, and then like do the next one and so on. And then, you know, that moved on to, you would encode that information in punch cards. So you had these machines where you would like basically like a fancy typewriter that would like make holes in a piece of cardboard, and then you would put the cardboard into like punch card readers, and then that would load it into the computer's memory. But still you were like programming in machine code, just the raw instructions that the processor was reading. But the first like programming languages, they would allow you to like write, rather than writing, I want to use like these specific machine instructions, you could use more like logical concepts, like, you know, do this number of times. And then that gets kind of, there's a thing called a compiler that takes that language, that sort of more natural language, and turns it into machine instructions. And there's a lot of like formal, what's the word? Like formal theory and practice that goes into like compiler writing. But basically, programming languages are like a formal definition of what they call a grammar, which is like, you know, the various like keywords you can use. Like you would have, when you were writing in Python or something, you have keywords like def to define a function, or for if you want to do a loop, or if you want to have an if statement. And the grammar defines like those keywords, and it defines how you can declare variables and how they can be manipulated and how you can call functions. And then the compiler like is able to take that grammar, they call it parsing it. It parses it into a series of tokens, and then it converts all of that at the end of a process into the instructions that, that the machine runs. And so the process of developing a language starts with, you know, what are the abstractions that I want to permit, right? And so like initially those abstractions were like, well, you know, I don't want to have to say like, oh, read this bit of memory and then write that bit of memory. Instead, let's give them names. Like, let's call them variables, and we can say like A and B instead of like this like specific memory address. But now, you know, at this point, there's all kinds of like more sophisticated like abstract concepts that you can model in programming languages. I mean, I guess I'm saying a lot of stuff, but it's hard to like specifically answer the question in like an accurate way. But like in terms of like modern programming language design, it usually starts from a position of like, what kind of software do people want to build with this thing? Right. And like maybe a programming environment that some of your viewers might be more familiar with is like, if you look at like Max, and that's like in Max for Live. Max is a visual programming environment where, you know, they started from the idea of like, okay, we want to like empower people who are not familiar or maybe don't want to be familiar with like a kind of text-based programming environment and allow them to do things like work with sound, work with hardware, you know, do. And so they created all of these primitives, and then they built all the infrastructure under that to turn like the instructions made from those primitives into something a computer can do.
Right. So it's just kind of like levels of abstraction. Like originally you had this, you had to tell the computer directly what to do right at the bit stage. And then you put another thing on top of that to like write words that then get turned through a compiler into bits. And then Max is like one more level even above that, where it's just like images that you draw wires between that then does some code stuff that then tells the thing to do the thing with bits.
Exactly. I was going to say, and in Max, you can write code that kind of, you know, dips lower in the abstraction, right? You can kind of be less visual if you want. Like, there's lots of levels. Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, do you envision like a more efficient way of telling a computer to do things than writing words in a text document or using something like Max to connect things together? Or like, at the end of the day, you still have to tell the computer, like, flip this bit, leave this bit the same, do this, do that. Is there a more efficient way to do it, you think, than the way we've been doing it? Or in the future, do you think there's going to be like a easier way to do it, or a more, you know,
well, I
just
hope
a
so.
Different way to do it, maybe?
I hope so. I mean, I think like the field of like programming language design is really all about that. It's really about asking, you know, can we make these jobs easier? And there's been a lot of investment in, you know, not text-based programming. I personally don't really feel like I think there's definitely a lot of interesting ideas there, but like, you know, we have books, we have like writing with text, and like that is one of the most immediate ways we have of like transferring knowledge, right? Like if you want to communicate like very precise ideas, like concepts to someone, if you write them all down in a book, then that is something that is like well preserved. It allows the reader to consume it at the rate that they're comfortable with. And there's like a lot of virtues to like the written word. And so I kind of see that like with programming, there's a reason why like programming in text works so well. And it's because, you know, it's a natural way of communicating. And ultimately programming is all about communicating. You're communicating with the machine, you're communicating with other programmers who read what you've written. But I mean, It's hard to say. Like, I started programming when I was really young, like five or something. It was when I first wrote some code. And so, like, if anyone
is, write code when you were five?
So my grandfather was an engineer, and he just always had, like, technology things. Like, he had a photocopier in his house, for instance. Like, it was a very strange thing to have when you're a retired guy in the 80s. But he also had several, like, computers. And as a kid, I was just always obsessed with anything technology, like the stereo, the VCR, like the TV, like anything. And I would always, like, unplug everything and, like, figure out how it all worked and, like, take things apart. And so when, I went to my grandfather's house and there were these computers there, it was like, that was, like, just magnetic to me, and it's what I wanted to be doing. And, like, with those early computers, you would turn them on and then you would just be at a prompt where you could type in code. Like, it was a basic programming language that was common on a lot of, like, computers in the early 80s. And yeah, you would just be dropped in there, and then what you would have to do is just write code. If you wanted to, like, run a program, you would have to write code to load the program from a disk or something. Like, it wasn't that was what you did with the computer, was write code. So, like, when I sat down there, like, my grandfather would be like, oh, well, type this in. Like, he showed me, like, what to do to, like, load a game off a disk or whatever. But then, also, in the 80s, there were these computer books, and, like, I borrowed some from the library, and, like, they would have, like, all the listings of, like, if you type all of this code in, you can play a game. It would give you, like, a couple of hundred lines of code, like, printed in a book, and you would just sit there and, like, type it all in, and then hopefully not make any mistakes, and then you hit run, and then you get to play, like, a basic game like Lunar Lander or Pong or something like that. And so that was, like, my earliest experience with that was, like, I was fortunate. I came along at a time when, like, the thing that you did with the computer was program, right? Like, that was, if you had a computer at home, that was, you had to know how to program at least a bit, or you couldn't do anything. And so that's where I started. And then my dad brought a computer home from work a couple of years later, and a similar story. And then, the whole world kind of got more sophisticated as I learned more stuff. And so, which is fortunate, because, like, I think if I was 5 years old now and you just put, like, an iPad in front of me, then, there's no chance that I'm going to just start programming it, right? Like,
it's going to go to, like, YouTube or play Subway Surfers or something.
Yeah, exactly.
True. How do you think AI is affecting programming? Like, have you been using ChatGPT a lot for writing code? I know there's something you can do with it. I haven't really messed around with that particular aspect of ChatGPT too much yet, but do you think that we're going to get to a point where you can say, hey, ChatGPT, code me this thing that does this and that on this computer, and I want to be able to load it this way and whatnot, and just have it write perfect code?
Yeah, it's a big question. And I think, like, the short answer is I don't think language models are going to be very useful for, like, building software, actually writing the code to do it. And this kind of,
why do, like, you think that?
Well, so just trying to think what the best place to start with this is. So it's like the thing that I spend the most time doing is, like, carefully, logically reasoning through subtle concepts. So, like, and there's a lot of things where it's like, There's like, if you start going down a road with some design choice, they'll often be like, there's a correct thing you should do or an incorrect thing. Should you do this thing if this variable is greater than that one or less than? There's lots of these, like, tiny decisions where you have to make the right logical choice or the code is wrong. And
wrong in the sense that it doesn't work, or wrong in the sense that it's just written
wrong. Yeah, it won't do what you want it to do. Yeah, okay, it won't actually function correctly. And the language models, they don't have the ability to reason, right? Like there's no logical reasoning happening there. It's just a statistics game of what is the likely thing to see here.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a glorified autocomplete, basically, right? Where it like essentially does a battle royale for every new letter it writes and decides like, what is the likelihood of this next letter being an O, 2%? What about a P? Oh, 99.9%. Okay, I'm going to put a P there.
Yeah,
and that's basically exactly how they work. It's funny because like a lot of people are like having these conversations like, oh man, I think like LLMs are low-key sentient, or like, you know, I think that they're able to do a lot more than they actually are, and all this kind of stuff. And I feel like what that comes down to is just humans being really easy to fool as to what is sentient. It's like you don't need much to convince us that something seems like it's conscious and seems like it's having its own experience and seems reasonable and logical and rational. And I guess, I don't know, maybe it's just because humans in general kind of, at least in my case, I find it just easier to understand things if I've been through that before and it's happened to me, right? And because my whole life experience has been logic and ration and, you know, the classic, all the stuff that a human has inside your experience. When I look at ChatGPT, it's very easy for me to use my experiences that I've had in that way and be like, that seems like that, because it's all I know. I don't in my brain have this like, you know, autocomplete function that happens every, but then again, the other side of that is all humans literally do have that autocomplete function, right? Because it's like, as I'm telling you this sentence, I don't necessarily know where this sentence ends or what word I'm going to pick next or anything like that. So in a way, maybe it is the same thing.
Well, I mean, we don't, I'm not an expert in the field, but as of like neuroscience or psychology, but like, I don't think there's like a single universally agreed upon definition of like what consciousness is anyway. So like, it's very hard to say, is this thing conscious or not, since we don't actually really understand how consciousness works. But like one thing that is definitely well understood is that like the processes that lead to us like having these experiences as like thinking, living, feeling beings, it's not like just one thing in your brain. It's like multiple systems working together in concert to like make the experience of yourself happen. And I think only like part of those, like only part of that is the conscious self, but there's actually lots of other systems that are definitely you, that you don't have any conscious control or awareness of. They're just things that happen. And you know, like the simplest example is like the autonomic system of like breathing and your heart beating. Like you can't like stop doing that consciously, even if you want to, right? You'll eventually, if you try to hold your breath, you'll pass out and then start breathing again. Like it's not something you can consciously influence in any like fundamental way. But like there would be a part of your brain, like when I'm talking, I don't like consciously think about all of the words I'm about to say. Like there is some really bizarre set of processes that, you know, I'm not thinking, oh, I want to move my mouth and my tongue and like breathe out at the same time as I'm talking. Like that's all this kind of there's some subconscious systems, and probably like my spinal cord is doing a lot of the work of like what I'm doing to talk. And yeah, so all of the things that make it possible to do that are all spread out through all these different places in the brain, in the body. So like, yeah, maybe there is a part of us that is like an LLM in some way. Maybe there is some analogous part, but it's only a part, right? Like, it's not like the whole thing. And I think it's kind of a bit foolish to think that if you look at what a human being or like any animal is, and then you look at what an LLM actually is, like to say that like they're just because they can kind of do some things in a similar way doesn't mean that they're like the same thing, right? Like a dog can run and a bike can like roll forward, but that doesn't make them like the same thing just because they can move forward. It's like you can be fooled because like a lot of the stuff that LLM's output looks like what humans do, but that's just because they've been given all this input of like what humans do. So it looks like that.
Mm. So the current state of AI, you would say, is like far from AGI. It's like not at all general intelligence.
I don't know what other developments are happening in the field of like AI. In terms of like AGI, I know that there are a lot of people working really hard on that. But I think that, you know, these large language models, I don't see any connection between them and like, there's not any clear path from that to like some generally intelligent computer.
It's like a
process.
Different thing completely almost.
Could be. I mean, maybe LLMs play a part of it, but it doesn't seem like sufficient to me. And again, like I'm not like an AI expert, but I've also been watching keenly and I'm definitely excited by it. But I think that the current kind of like fervor around these language models is, you know, capitalists see it as a way to get cheaper product that they can sell. And that explains the massive investment. And, you know, the companies that are building the stuff like NVIDIA and other large corporations have a big interest in, you know, riding this wave because, you know, there's cash to be made. So I'm not really like, and I'm very like as an artist and as an art enjoyer, like I really don't approve of the way like these big companies are just hoovering up data, like artwork, you know, works produced by people without compensating them for their work and feeding them into this stuff that they're then using to make money. Like, it doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah, I agree. Did you see there was this interview with, I don't think it was the CEO of OpenAI, but it was like...
The CTO? Was it?
The lady.
Yeah. She was talking about lady Sora, the video.
Yeah, exactly. And the interviewer goes like, what did you train? I think she said like, what did you train it on? Like, where'd you get the data? Or was it like, did you train it on videos from YouTube? And she like pulled the weirdest face. She's like, oh, like, don't ask me that question. And then I think refused to answer and was just like, don't worry about it. We don't have to get into it. which was kind of concerning. I mean, yeah, I disagree that you should be able to just take information off the internet like that and train models with it for something that you're going to make to sell, basically. If you like just training models for yourself, you know, that's completely different. But I think, yeah, training a large language model, or sorry, like a diffusion model or whatever Sora is operating on with other people's work and then selling that as a service that people can use, yeah, that's kind of fucked up.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that interview was crazy. Like, you'd think that you would come to that to an interview like that with a very well prepared answer to that question, right? Like, that's obviously a question that's going to be asked.
Yeah, but totally. Yeah. And I mean, I guess the problem lies in that right now there just is no law surrounding that specific thing. It's like all gray area. Like, can you take, like, is it infringing on copyright? I mean, it's hard to say, right? Like, I had a lawyer on the podcast the other day and he was saying that the copyright really only protects like making copies of something. So for instance, if I like, you know, take one of your tracks, copy it onto my hard drive, that's technically an infringement of copyright. It's just an infringement that nobody gives a shit about because it's like not affecting anybody and nobody even knows about it for the most part. So I guess they're
really
trying to figure out.
Actually.
Oh, yeah, cheers. Yeah, so I guess the part they're talking about is, like, is putting the file into the AI to train it, is that making a copy? And I think it's a pretty gray area because technically it's not, but it kind of is. I mean, I don't really know. But I guess they would have to make copies of all the data anyway to put somewhere on a drive to point the model trainer towards or something. I'm also curious, like, if the model that they train is a single model that's just training for like months on this giant pile of data, or if they train a bunch of models on like types of data, like, you know, all the funny cartoon videos, all of the ballerinas dancing videos, etc., and then like somehow converge all these models together into like one monster model, or if what you see on the front end is just like a text field where you can write stuff, but depending on what you write, it like goes to grab from one of these many models. I'm kind of curious. Yeah, it sucks that we like really don't have any info on that either.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't have really any visibility into that anyway. I mean, whenever I talk to people who are like working in AI stuff, like, you know, there's a lot of people going, well, you know, we don't really know. Like, we're just like trying things, you know, just trying, like, there's a lot of just throwing things at the wall and seeing what sticks. So I think, you know, I think the companies that are really, sort of leading the way, they just have like a huge amount of resources, and they're able to like compute resources and also like engineering resources, and they're just like trying so many different approaches. And yeah, I mean, I bet there are models that are just like, let's train this on everything versus like, let's train this on a subset of things.
I heard that because like LLMs and pretty much all AI stuff is based on GPU computing power, and obviously GPUs and CPUs need a lot of cooling because they get hot, that something like 30 entries or something into ChatGPT will chug like half a gallon of water, which is kind of wild, just in cooling fluid, like, I guess, water needed to cool the GPUs. So it's kind of wild.
Well, I was reading about, you know, the power requirements of these like compute farms with all the, you know, the GPUs and everything, and it's like, you know, tens or hundreds of megawatts for like a cluster. Like, that's like a city's worth of power. I really question whether any of this is necessary and whether, you know, like, this sort of environmental cost is, I'm sure that it is not worth the environmental cost, right? Like, I don't believe that at all. I don't think that anything we've seen come out of language models is worth what it's cost us so far. And it's actually really interesting. Mm. Like, obviously companies like OpenAI and others are like, you know, they're charging a bit for the services, but like, what happens when, you know, they're like, all right, well, we actually have to start turning a profit now. We can't just keep throwing money into this black hole. And when they start charging like what it actually costs to do the generation stuff, like, will it be cost effective at all? Right. Like,
Will anybody even pay for it? Or
yeah, will it be like, oh, actually, it's cheaper for me to just get a copywriter than to like write all these, you know, use these models. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see if the price goes up that much to where it would be more cost effective to get a ghost producer to make your music than an AI.
Well, yeah, actually, I wanted to ask you about that, like, because I've heard you like on the podcast talk about, you know, we already have like things like Dance Diffusion or whatever that can like give you variations on a sound, right? And obviously, it's like a logical step to think, oh, you could train it on like project files and then get it to generate project files for you, which, you know, compared to like a waveform, like a project file has a lot more things that there's a lot more space in that problem space where it's not going to be a song at all, let alone a song that you want to listen to. So it's like training that is obviously probably orders of magnitude more difficult. But like, let's say that there were models where you could hit generate and then get a song. Like, Do you think that's A, likely, and like B, like what do you, how do you feel about that, like as a as an artist who writes music, like what is that inspiring you to think about that?
Well, I don't think it would come from a project file. I think you would like when making something to generate music, you would make the problem way smaller by just doing wave files, because then it's, you know, just 44,000 samples per second, and any of those samples can be, you know, somewhere in the range of like, you know, maybe a 70 or 80,000 different possible volumes at any point in time, right? So I think it's much easier to just train it on WAV files and have it spit WAV files out. And there are already things that exist like this where you can just put in a text prompt and it will spit out a tune. And I've heard varying levels of quality come out of these, but I have actually heard some like pretty decent tunes come out of certain AI softwares.
Decent, like you would like listen to it?
Yeah. Like I would actually listen to it and be like, this is not bad. It's pretty good. It's there's actually some pretty amazing shit happening out there. But, and how I feel about it as an artist is every time I've generated something with AI and I'm like, damn, this is pretty cool, my initial knee-jerk reaction as an artist is to change shit about it anyway. Like, oh, I'm going to put this through StemRoller and turn this wave generation into stems, and then I'm going to put that back into Ableton and I'm going to chop it all up and like change it all. And I feel like that's just a necessary part of making music for me to feel like any sense of ownership over it, or any sense of like me being a part of it, even if it was trained on my stuff, which I've also done. And I just feel like I never see myself generating a track using AI and then being like, sick, let's fucking release it. You know, like I would just never do that. I just, me personally, I feel weird about that. I could imagine some people would, especially if it were like, you know, you just needed a little bit of music in the background of a game, or like you're a filmmaker, you don't really know how to make music, you're running low on budget and you just want to put some music in your intro, or like, you know, so there's something between dial or something, you know.
But I mean, I can't imagine like, I with that example, like there's just no way that if you're a filmmaker, you can't find a musician who just wants to do the music for you. Right. Like,
yeah, it's also true.
If you're low budget, like some musician will want to do that because they want to make music. So I feel like, what kind of filmmaker are you that you wouldn't even like want to have a like, because filmmaking is such a collaborative thing, right? So like, obviously, I don't know. I find that kind of bizarre. Actually, it kind of makes me think about like, you know, there's so much music being made, like way more music than anyone can listen to. And like, you know, Spotify or whatever is just full of like so many tracks that like have tens or hundreds of views or listens. And like the reason people listen to artists is because they have some kind of like emotional connection to like the artist. Like it's not just the music. Like I think there's a very small subset of music listeners who listen to music because purely for like the music content. A lot of people have like they care about who the artist is. So I like, as far as like art's concerned, I feel like, you know, the kind of AI bro attitude of like, artists, you know, your days are numbered, like losers, like get a real job. I feel like that's just fundamentally misguided, because like people care about the artist, like they're invested in the artist. It's not like, it's not just about the end product, although obviously that's important.
Right. But you could like, also create this entire product through AI things too, right? Like for instance, if I outputted, you know, a million songs, or let's say, I don't know, 10,000 songs out of like a AI thing, and then I outputted 10,000 artworks out of, you know, Stable Diffusion or something, it would still take me picking the right art for the right songs and packaging them up in the correct ways and like creating a story around it and, you know, creating some like lore around it and all that kind of stuff. And I feel like that's a big part of like an artist, some artists' projects as well. But the the thing that I've found and that I think we'll find with AI generation is it will just speed up the ability to try a lot of different things quickly. Like, for instance, I don't know if you've ever had this experience in a project file where you're like, oh, I kind of want to try like a different idea for a build-up or like this different drop flow or whatever, but my project file is just so constipated that like it would take me, you know, an hour just to try this one thing kind of. And that will often discourage me at least from even trying an idea because I'll just be like, oh, fuck it, it's fine how it is. And like, I'll just give up on that or I'll let the track sit there for like a year and then come back to it and maybe have like the will to do it. But with AI, you could just quickly generate like, you know, 50 different versions of the track. You can put it into the thing and say, generate me different versions of this, or just generate random versions and quickly just like cut together wave files to try a bunch of shit and then be like, all right, this is good. And then just rebuild that in the way that you'd envision. So it's kind of like, you know, in a way, like maybe helpful for prototyping. And I feel like the same would be true for film, right? It's like, yeah, a filmmaker could find somebody who writes music for sure, but like maybe they don't know exactly what kind of music they want. So maybe it'd be beneficial to go like generate a bunch of shit with AI, throw a bunch of stuff underneath the film whilst you're editing it or whatever and be like, okay, that kind of sounds cool and that sounds like, you know, Mr. Bill, so let me go ask him to do it. Or
I mean, well, they do already do that, like with,
yeah, know, with temp music.
There's so much of it.
Right. And is there a ethical difference, or is it more ethically problematic to use an AI generated thing than a temp thing that you don't have the rights to use anyway?
I mean, I think if you're not selling the, like my, I mean, I'm not a professional artist, so like I have less skin in the game, like in that sense, but I just feel like if you're not selling what you've made, then you're not like, you can do whatever you want, really. Like I don't really have an issue with that.
You mean selling or distributing at all? Because sometimes you could distribute something for free without selling it and it still benefits you in the sense of gaining fans, right? Because then you can like remonetize them later in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, obviously in this world where so much content is just like given away, but you make money through other avenues, I would qualify like, yeah, using it in a public way.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's just temp, then and you never distribute it, then if it's just part of your process, it's like, you know, I shouldn't feel bad that I like would put one of your tunes on while I'm playing piano to like think about, like to develop a chord progression that I would then use in something else. Like, obviously, like, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that. But I would draw a line at like, if you're using, you know, models to produce works, you know, derived from other people's work without their permission, then that's like, and then distributing it, then there's something wrong with that.
If you're distributing the stuff generated from the model directly, maybe, but what if you generate things from that model and then use that as a catalyst for getting ideas from, then is it okay?
I mean, what do you think?
I don't think it's any different from getting an idea from listening to somebody else's music, full stop, which is kind of what we all do anyway. Like, there's no artist on this planet, I feel like, who's never listened to anybody else's music and therefore cannot argue that they didn't get the idea from listening to something
else. For sure. I mean, it's kind of like the sampling debate, you know, that we had in the 80s and 90s, like, and obviously, like, we ended up in the situation where you can't just, like, sample someone's work without compensating them. Like, that's
it's the arm and break, then it's fine, apparently.
So somehow. Is that true for all the major breaks, like the Apache break and everything? Can you just, like,
who are they going to sue at this point? Everyone?
The world.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what are you
going to... Jungle Incorporated.
Maybe, I don't know if, like, I don't even know if there's ever been a court case over the armor break. Let me look this up real quick.
I often think about, like, the Armin break, like, what if that drummer at that moment, you know, the people in that room, if they could know, like, what would come of this few seconds of time, like, that would just be so mind-blowing if it would be possible to
like, damn, to that thing you just yeah, that thing you just played there, like, that took you, you know, 2 seconds to play and record, is going to spawn an entire genre and culture.
It's like, these are some of the most influential seconds of recorded music ever.
I'm going to have to look into this later, but I don't see anything about court cases on the Wikipedia page for the Armin break, so I don't know if anything has come of that. But yeah, I wonder how the people feel who made the Armin break. I wonder if there's any interviews with them. And I should probably look into
that. I feel like I read one. From memory, I don't think they were very... I don't think they were really that stoked, was my recollection, but I could just be totally misremembering.
Yeah, I mean... I don't know how I would feel about it. I think I would be pretty stoked, though. I also, especially if I were not successful at all and this happened to something of mine, I'd be like, that sucks. But like, if I was already really successful and then this also happened and it spawned a whole culture and shit, I don't think I would worry too much. I think I'd be okay with that.
I'm pretty sure James Brown was asked about it, like, because, you know, his little, like, vocal stabs are in so much stuff, but he was a pretty like cantankerous sort of eccentric guy anyway, so I can't imagine he was like thrilled about it.
True. He also probably made like $1 billion over his career, so I'm sure he's not sweating the money at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think by reputation he was pretty like fierce about like guarding and his income. And you know, there's the famous stories of like he would dock the pay of his musicians if they made a mistake and stuff like that. I don't know. He was a pretty wild guy, but amazing guy.
Have you ever checked out Clint Eastwood's social media? He like he'll put like 10 watermarks on his photos. It's crazy. Somebody showed me this earlier today. Actually, it was the lawyer that I had on the other day. He showed me this. Yeah, it's like there'll be like a picture of Clint Eastwood standing there with like his wife or daughter or whatever, and there's just like 10 fucking watermarks on the photo because he's so I guess like people
like his Instagram or something. So
I think so. I guess because people like use his images a lot or something, so he's like, the way that I get around that is by putting like 10 watermarks on the photo.
I mean, yeah, make it unusable. That's a good strategy.
Yeah.
You could have just like, you could release your next tunes with just your album with just like a promo ID. Hi everyone, this is Mr. Bill, just like all the way through.
I'll just like take an episode of my podcast and just put it on top of the thing. There's this AI voice website where you can like put you could just talk into your microphone, put it in. It's called Voice Swap, and it will like turn the talking or the singing, the shitty singing that you did, into like a really nice sounding vocal. And these things have watermarks in them that I noticed. If you like look at the files that come out of there, there's like these 5 sine waves right up around like the 21 kilohertz region that are in there specifically, I think, for watermarking. Because the idea is that like, if you do use these vocals and then you want to professionally release them, that you have to like buy a license from the artist behind it, which I think is pretty ethical and cool. And I guess the way
nothing a low pass filter won't cure.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Maybe.
I noticed that I was in all of them, and yeah, you can just get rid of it with a low pass filter.
I mean,
but
that may not be the only part.
Yeah, there might be more watermarks in it. Yeah, audio watermarking is crazy.
Yeah, I don't pretend to know how that works, but like from like a knowing a bit about like cryptography and like cryptanalysis, like the amount of signal you can recover from noise, it doesn't surprise me that you could like fully watermark like an audio signal in a way that's really detectable.
Yeah, and specifically, obviously, the filer becomes way easier because then you can just like use metadata as well.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting if all this like AI stuff ends up with us having more systems for like tagging like content with like the creators, right?
Like, I'm hoping AI ends up is that we all have a personal therapist and a personal doctor and a personal, you know, whatever in our pocket at all times. I think that would be the most ideal outcome is like, I have a red lump and I feel like this, what's going on? And it's just able to be like, you've got this problem, you need to do this.
Yeah.
I feel like that would be pretty helpful. Or therapy, right? Like having something that's like so empathetic and so good at like understanding mental health that you can just talk to it and it can somehow make you feel better. I guess part of therapy is the human connection to the right? Like going to actually hang out with another human and
kind of I feel like that's like a critical piece of
it. It's like maybe the main part of it, yeah. Yeah, I guess you can't really like therapy your way out of a lot of shit just with words, right? But with that easy, like you could just kind of logic yourself out of it probably.
Well, yeah, I mean, I assume like we've both been in therapy and it's like there is something about saying the words to a person and seeing them just like listen to you that is like there's a fundamentally therapeutic thing about that. I don't think I would feel the same just like saying it into some computer chips.
What if the computer looked like a human and it was so believable that you felt like it was a human? Like it was able to fool your brain. Or what about VR? Like what if you go into VR and you sit down on a chair, there's another person over there. You can like talk to an AI that in VR that kind of seems normal.
I mean, I guess so. Like I'm so... Like I've been on the computer like so much. Like I turned 40 last year and
congrats.
Like, yeah, made it. But like, I'm really getting over computers and technology, like in general. I'm trying to spend more and more time like out in the world and with people. And I really feel like this kind of, it's also really related to capitalism. Like computers are this great tool for like, you know, building on capital. And we've seen how like computers have just like eaten the economies of the world. And, you know, it's all these big software companies that are the big ones. And, you know, I like have some pretty big misgivings about like the general direction, like in terms of like, you know, you mentioned like having a doctor in your pocket or like a therapist or whatever, you know, we have so many people employed, in totally unnecessary fields like insurance or advertising, you know, things that are purely about advancing capital interests that don't actually produce anything, when we could instead just like, there could be enough therapists that you could just like call one, you know, there could be doctors that you could just call and they would be available because there are enough of them. Right. And then, you know, people like those people would have meaningful jobs to do that would make them feel like they were doing something positive for the world, right? Like I just feel like we have so much, like on a global level, like that we have everything that this, you know, we could have a much bigger population and still have enough for everyone, but we're just so wasteful, you know, like. And I just feel like a lot of these, when I was much younger, I used to think that, you know, technology would really help us, you know, do things more efficiently and therefore give people a lot more leisure time. You know, like, why do we need to work so much? And it's because for capital owners, it suits them for us to be working a lot. Like that just suits the status of the powerful status quo. And so I've kind of become this kind of like anti-capitalist. Like I really feel like, a lot of what we have a lot of what we've built as a civilization really needs to be deconstructed. I don't have like suggestions as to how to go about that, but like I definitely have seen how like my, you know, childhood, like thinking about technology, reading sci-fi books and stuff, you know, you have this kind of like Star Trek future where, you know, everyone on Earth just like lives this chill life and then they go off into space and like explore and like everything's cool. But like if you sort of extrapolate from present day, like the future doesn't look like that for humanity. So like, yeah, I find it hard to get excited about a lot of these technological things, which immediately kind of get co-opted by like capitalist interests instead of like thinking, how can this be better for humans? It's like, just how can we make money with this? And that's kind of like,
yeah, like, I guess Bitcoin was kind of like that, right? It's like, let's create this thing that completely, you know, circumvents all of the banks and, you know, all of this shit. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, now this is just all centralized and controlled by the people who hold the most of it, basically. Like Coinbase, yeah, it's like
the crypto community, like cryptocurrency community, just like rediscovering all the reasons why we have all of the banking things that we do. Like,
now we just have like 50 more banks, but they're just more sus, like FTX.
Yeah, and like most of them are scams. Like almost, yeah. In fact, I mean, basically all of it is a scam because none of it. Like nothing that any of the cryptocurrency or like Web3 pundits have like been describing has come to fruition. It's just not, you know, it's just not happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible AI could also be that way. It's instead of my view of, oh, maybe we'll have like, you know, a therapist and a doctor in our pocket, it'll just be like, no, we just have people who want to make more money having more control again. Sorry.
And like so much more, I feel like, you know, it's great for scammers as well, because like,
right, you could just have this like ruthless thing just calling people constantly and being like just talking to them,
using the voice of people they know, you know, that's a scam that's happening, right? You get a call from someone that sounds like your child and they're saying, I'm in trouble, like send me some money. It's crazy. I mean, yeah, I don't mean to be depressing, but I do feel like, yeah, I do feel like it's, there are problems.
there definitely are. Well, hey, man, I got to go get some food and stuff, but I appreciate you doing this podcast. I'm glad that we're finally able to do it, and yeah, appreciate it.
I actually looked, like, the last time when you first asked, it was actually, like, over 3 years ago. Was the message. I was gonna like hit reply to that message in Discord and be like, hey, so yeah, I'm around. So yeah, great to chat.
Thanks for listening to the Mr. Bill podcast. Credit to Robert Fumo for the production and edit. Join MrBillsTunes.com for early access to the video podcast, tutorials, sample packs, and more. And please consider rating and reviewing us on all pod thingies, because it really helps the podcast.